Love your enemies. As an interreligious and interfaith chaplain at a university, I know that every religious and spiritual tradition in some way embodies that ethic in their teaching. And as an ordained Christian pastor, I know that those are Jesus' words, and they are at the heart and center of what we in the Christian tradition are taught about who we are and what we're called to. And what I know as a human being is that's some hard shit. That regardless of what your perspective might be spiritually or religious, to love one's enemy is maybe perhaps the hardest thing to figure out how to do in one's life and to make sense of in one's life. About almost 10 years ago now, I was ordained to the ministry, and I was ordained at Trinity Presbyterian Church. It's a small church right on the edge of the hilltop in the north end here in Tacoma, and I spent 7 years there as a pastor, and I remember my ordination day. It's one of those culmination days, right? It's one of those days that just you've worked so hard. You've put in so much time and effort, seminary and hours of study and the ministry work and all the requirements that your denomination makes you go through and all these things and all the people that help you along the way, and it's this amazing day. And I remember sitting in that small sanctuary and looking out and seeing all the congregation members and family and friends and people that I loved and who'd walked on this journey and mentors. And one of the most profound and emotional parts of that service is always the time in which they lay hands on you. At the end of the service, you kneel, and the whole congregation comes forward, and they lay their hands on you, and they affirm your call into this work, and they give you their blessing. I remember in that moment, as everyone's crying and it's so emotional and powerful, I realized that what had gotten me there was not just those hands that were upon me extending their blessing, but that in many ways what had gotten me to that point in my life was the hands that weren't there. And for me, they were the hands of my enemy. You see, as much help as I had had by those people who loved me, my whole life had been really motivated by this hatred and this need to prove an enemy wrong in my life. So much of what I seek and sought after was to prove that I was more than this enemy had said that I was. And even in that moment, I knew that that was true. So when I was 13 years old, my mom went away for a few days, and she left me and my baby sister at home with my stepfather. And it was the last night before my mom was going to be coming home, and I was sitting at the kitchen table doing my homework, and my stepdad had just put my baby sister to bed, and he entered back into the room, and he began to lay into me, which was the norm. He just began to lay into me. It didn't matter what the offense was. It was never about the offense. It was just whatever I had. He just had this need to control me. He had this need to break me down and to crush me at every chance that he could get, to disparage me, to do whatever he could do to just make me fearful and make me question everything about myself. And so I'd heard enough, and I kept an outer exterior that showed that I was unaffected, but inside, of course, I was raging, and I quietly stacked my books, and I began to walk to my room to remove myself from the situation. And that enraged him, of course. And he said, "Don't you fucking turn your back on me." And before I could turn around, he kicked me in the backside, and I went sprawling across the kitchen floor. And just as I turned over to face him, he stomped on my groin, and he said, "Don't cry, that didn't hurt. Your balls aren't big enough for that to hurt." And then he jumped on my chest and he began to punch me in the face. And as he's doing that, he's screaming what the things he always screamed: you're so fucking pathetic. You're weak just like your father was weak. You're a fucking fat piece of shit. You're a pussy. I'm gonna teach you what it means to be strong, what it means to be a man. Why don't you ever listen to me? Why do you think you're so smart? And all of a sudden he stops punching me as he notices the blood and the black eye and the cuts. And I think he realizes that he's leaving a mark, which is problematic for him. And so finally he gets up. He turns away and he says, "Get the fuck out of my sight. Go to bed." And I do, and I go to bed, and I remember that night I begin a ritual. And the ritual was a ritual that I did many times later after a good beating or a good fight with him, where I would lay in my bed, shaking with rage and fear and anger, and I would hold a baseball bat across my chest. And I would fantasize. I would fantasize about waiting for him to go to sleep and going in and beating him to death because I didn't think I could take anymore. I didn't think I could do this anymore. I wanted it to end. And the other thing that I did during that ritual is I promised myself that I would win. I promised myself that I would show him that he was wrong about me, that I would make something of myself, that I would be more than he thought that I could be. And that resolve sunk deeply within me, and that chip got really big. And I basically lived my life to say, F you to my stepfather. By some grace, I never took that bat in on him, and I still don't know why that was. But a few years later, when I was 17, at the beginning of my junior year in high school, I moved out of my house for good. And I remember my mom sitting before me, and she's crying and weeping and begging me not to go, and she's saying, don't make me choose between my husband and my son. And she's saying, you know, I know he's done this before, but it'll be different this time. He really has changed. Something really has happened. He really is committed to being different. And finally, I looked at my mother because I knew that was true. I knew if there was one more fight that it was not going to end well, that someone was going to die. I was going to take his life. He was going to take my life. And so I looked at my mom and I said, okay, you don't have to choose. I'll choose for you. And I'm leaving. And that began the quest. That began the quest of proving that I was not who he said I was. The quest of proving that I could be someone. And so I moved out of my house, and a family took me in, and friends and family and mentors in my life and their love and my faith helped kind of put my life back together. And I committed to that journey. And I stopped drinking and doing so many drugs, and I got my grades up, and I earned a football scholarship, and I went away. I met a girl that I loved and that loved me, and we had this desire to build a life together, and I went away to college, and I became a leader and had new experiences and graduated from college and got married and begun my career and read everything I could read and put myself before teachers who could teach me wisdom. And there I was at that moment, that culmination, that ordination ceremony that was sort of the culmination of all that work, that thing that kind of represented having in so many ways arrived and become the person that he said I could never be and someone that was worthy and valuable and strong and all of the things that he didn't believe about me. And so I remember the next day after my ordination service, I got a phone call from my mom. Of course, they'd been here for the service, and they'd gone back to Yakima where I grew up. And I answered the phone, and I said, what's up? And my mom is crying and hysterical on the other end of the line. And she says, well, this morning your stepfather walked out in the backyard of his apartment, stuck a pistol in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. Would you come home? So I made haste. I made haste to go and be with my mom and my little sister. And it was the week of my sister's high school graduation. Of course, she was a mess. And when I got there, my sister really thought that she wanted to go and see the body initially, that she needed some sense of closure. And so we went. We went to the medical examiner's office to see the body. And when we got there, we had to wait as they got the body prepared, and pretty soon they let us know that we could go in, and we began to walk towards the door, and pretty soon my sister grabbed my arm and stopped me and said, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't go in. And she began to cry and burst into tears. I said, it's okay. It's okay. You don't need to go in. So we got back in the car, and we drove home. And we drove home in silence, utter silence except for her crying and weeping. The windows were down, the smell of fruit growing on the trees in Yakima, and in that moment, I knew what I had to do. And so I dropped my sister off. I said, I'm going to go for a drive and go meet a friend for a drink. I'll be back in a little bit. You go get some rest. And I went back to the medical examiner's office. And I walked in to that place and said, could I see the body? And they said, sure. So they let me in, and the other end of the room, there he was. And I walked slowly closer and closer until I stood over the top of him. And he looked so much older than I remembered, weathered and cold and lifeless. No life in his eyes, such sadness. His face and head tried to put back together in some semblance, but it was pretty messy. And I began to cry. I began to weep and cry, and I did this really interesting thing. I didn't lay hands on him, but I did say a prayer. And in some ways, that might be where my ministry really started. The hardest work I would ever have to do, where I begin to learn what it meant to love one's enemy. And this isn't a fairy tale happy ending. I'm not going to tell you that I forgave Jim for everything or that I even fully loved him in that moment. But what happened in that moment was I realized that he wasn't the real battle. That I was always who I was. That I was always who I was. And that I'd been living this life of trying to fight and needing an enemy to essentially justify my existence. I didn't know how to live or strive unless it was over and against someone or fighting against someone. And it was such a tiring way to live. And I wanted to quiet that voice. And in that moment, I realized that though he was the monster, he was also a human being. He was a human being. And I may not have felt full love or forgiveness, but what I felt in that moment was compassion. And I realized if this work that I was called to was about anything else, it was about the ability to look at that which is the hardest to look at, that which is so hard, and to be able to see the humanity and to feel some level of compassion. And so I used his name. His name was Jim, a human being, the boy they used to call Jimmy. And I said that prayer, and I simply said, Jim, I don't forgive you. I don't even love you. But may you rest in peace, and may I finally have peace. Thank you.